From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And this morning at a meeting with county sheriffs at the White House, President Trump was asked why he thinks the media are underreporting terrorist attacks, something he accused journalists of doing in a speech yesterday.
I happen to know how dishonest the media is. I happen to know that stories about me that should be good or bad, you know, I don't mind a bad story if it's true, but I don't like bad stories. Stories that should be a positive story, when they make them totally negative, I understand the total dishonesty of the media better than anybody.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now from New York. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first of all, take on that question of whether the media is underreporting terror attacks. The Trump administration provided a list to make its point. The list had a lot of spelling errors in it, but it also included attacks that were covered extensively, including the attack in San Bernardino and the one in Orlando.
And in Paris and in Nice,
right,
and in Brussels and in Istanbul and all over. We had colleagues sprinting to go there. We had colleagues based in some of those places. And we, you know, are joined by our competitors and colleagues at other news organizations that covered that fully. You know, it's an assertion without any grounding in fact. It just simply is. It may well be that the administration feels that somehow the media doesn't cover what folks do to combat terrorism sufficiently. But this is certainly not an argument to be made. It's worth noting two things also. It's worth noting that it doesn't include things like the attack by a white shooter in a church in South Carolina in which 9 black people at church were killed. That was considered an act of domestic terrorism. It didn't include the attack on the mosque in Quebec City not so many days ago, which was an attack on people who are Muslim. So, you know, it's a very specific kind of terrorism that's being identified there. The one thing that it accomplishes, whether consciously or not, is that we're all talking now about terror and threats and attacks and saying, look, we covered these things, but the subject now is in the top of the headlines and the top of the news at a time when, of course, the Trump administration is defending an incredibly restrictive immigration ban that it says would keep people out of these 7 predominantly Muslim countries as an effort to combat terrorism. So we're, in a sense, talking about the administration's deeply deceptive assertions, but about a subject that they're trying to use to justify a policy that's come under attack and challenge by federal judges in several courtrooms around the country.
Well, and when you put these attacks on the media in context and together with the attacks on a federal judge in Washington State from President Trump, Trump tweeting, just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system, people pouring in bad. The Washington Post has a story today on whether Trump is setting up to blame both the media and the judiciary if there's another attack. What do you think about that?
He's certainly rhetorically laying the groundwork for that. Absolutely. And I think that's in keeping with the kind of rhetoric you've seen from Steve Bannon, the chief strategist and advisor to President Trump, who came, of course, as the guiding chairman of Breitbart News, which has argued, of course, that there need to be more significant restrictions on folks coming into this country because of terror concerns, but also that has had part of its DNA blaming the media and saying that it's undermining the nation's national security. So I do think that the idea that what Trump has done, in effect, is serves to undermine and to point blame at the media and at the courts and at those who either dissent from him or provide alternate source of information or reality, is a real concern. I think it absolutely is a concern in a democratic system that relies on checks and balances.
Well, and speaking of which, we spoke with constitutional scholar Alan Dershowitz yesterday, who said Trump's attacks on the judiciary are not yet a constitutional crisis. Here he is.
President saying things does not constitute a crisis, but a president refusing to obey an order of a court would constitute a crisis. And we're not seeing that, at least not yet.
David, we've seen presidents attack legal decisions they don't like before. We've seen certainly presidents attack the media before. But does this feel different to you?
It's just so early in the term to come out fighting against all these other players in the democratic system. That's what's different. If you think of Nixon, perhaps the classic thing. Clinton came to office, was bruised pretty quickly by the press, but his impeachment crisis didn't undermine the the distinctiveness of the press, although he fought with it. You know, there are those legal scholars, including Professor Dershowitz's Harvard Law colleague, Lawrence Tribe, who argues that Trump may be preparing himself for an impeachment exposure because that there may be some sort of constitutional crisis. But as Dershowitz says, it hasn't happened. There were some claims by lawyers that perhaps federal agencies or administration officials were trying to slow walk compliance with the court rulings in some of these decisions, as in the state in Washington. If that proved to be the case, you could see some real constitutional clashes there. What we're hearing is the rhetoric of combat and clash. We haven't heard the reality take place quite yet.
David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. David, thanks.
You bet.
Well, let's get an update now on the offensive launched last October to retake the Iraqi city of Mosul from ISIS. Iraqi troops supported by Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and advised on the ground by U.S. troops have clawed back most of the eastern part of the city. The effort to retake the west is about to begin, and the U.N. is warning that the fighting could force more than 200,000 civilians to flee. Mike Giglio is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He was in Mosul recently. He's returned to nearby Erbil. He joins us by Skype. And Mike, describe the situation in Mosul.
So I was in eastern Mosul last week, which, as you mentioned, is mostly cleared from ISIS now. And it was surprising, actually. Areas that had been the scene of heavy fighting just a couple weeks ago had civilians in the streets, had markets running, had civilian traffic driving up and down the city as if things were almost back to normal.
This has to be a real morale boost for those Iraqi troops.
It is, and especially because it was such a long slog to win the east. You know, when they went into eastern Mosul this fall, they actually thought that would be the easiest part of the operation and that it would be over relatively quickly. And instead, it really turned into a difficult fight, and they took a lot of casualties. Mm. So I think to finally have reached the banks of the Tigris and to be able to say that they've controlled that part of the city now was really a big moment for them.
We remember when reporters like Arwa Damon were embedded with the troops and they got stuck in narrow alleys and they got set up by ISIS fighters who trapped them. I mean, it was really very difficult. But what about this next phase, the West?
It's going to be much, much more difficult. The street fighting is going to intensify. It's a lot more built up. It's a lot more densely populated. Iraqi special forces who have been leading the fight have relied to a large extent on being able to do so from their armored Humvees. Mm-hmm. And they might not be able to do that in the West. It's going to be, I think, house-to-house fighting, clearing houses on foot. There's probably a lot of IEDs in the area, and I think it's just going to be a lot slower and more difficult going.
Well, when you hear more congested, because we remember the images of the Humvees that couldn't fit down these alleys, and that's why they were getting stuck in the east. So now they go into the west. Look, what role is the U.S. military playing in this?
The U.S. military plays a key role in this and has throughout. You know, they were the ones that, or the U.S. generally was the party that brought people together behind the scenes, that got the Iraqis and the Kurds to cooperate. And who put down a lot of the planning for the battle. Beyond that, you know, as you mentioned, there's U.S. advisors embedded with Iraqi troops. There's U.S. airstrikes constantly being called in by the troops on the front lines and also beyond in strategic strikes. So they're really involved in just every facet of the war.
So this is a success story for the American military as well. And just brings up a question. It comes at a time when President Trump, as you know, has instituted these travel bans on certain countries, including Iraq. We spoke to your fellow journalist, Borzu Daragahi, when that travel ban was first instituted. And he said at the time that he felt it was endangering American troops because here they were fighting alongside Iraqi troops who were hearing that while they were fighting ISIS and dying fighting ISIS, there was a ban on them traveling to the U.S. Since that time, since it was first instituted, an Iraqi translator for American troops who was trying to come to the U.S. was detained because of that travel ban. Did you hear any reaction to this from the Iraqi troops that you spoke with or even the American troops?
Yeah, it was surprising, actually, the extent to which the Iraqi troops, even in Mosul when I was there, had been paying attention to the news. And they were upset by it. As I mentioned, it was a really difficult fight to this point, and they've taken really, really serious casualties and made a lot of sacrifice. And I think just the message that sent to them, and this is how they described to me, was one of lumping them in with terrorists when from their perspective, they're the ones on the front lines fighting that same enemy. Mm. So I think they really just resented being grouped together like that.
Do you see it in any way affecting the fight against ISIS?
I don't actually. I think it hurts their morale, and I think it's a bad message to send to them. And, you know, I spoke to the senior special forces general for the Iraqis in Mosul, and he said that. He said this is a hit to their morale, and it's not something that we need to deal with. But beyond that, I think that the message from the soldiers that I received was our relationship with the U.S. military goes back to 2003. We've been fighting alongside the Americans for more than a decade. So we're not going to let this one action define our relationship with the U.S. military. Yeah. I think from their perspective, their relationship is bigger than that, bigger than one administration or just one action from a new administration. I asked a soldier specifically about this, and he said, you know, we know the Americans. We've been fighting alongside them for more than a decade, and they know us. So I think that's where it stands. The cooperation will continue. I think just the messaging was difficult for them.
That's Mike Giglio, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News in Erbil in Iraq. He recently returned from Mosul. Mike, please stay safe and thank you.
Thanks a lot.
How do you teach your kids about spending money? And how early should you start? That's the subject of a book out today by financial writer Beth Kobliner. She served on President Obama's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans. And her book is called Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. She joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, great to be here.
And what would you say is the biggest mistake that parents make when it comes to teaching their kids about money?
I think that parents get so afraid that they don't know enough that they don't really talk about it. And then when their kid is maybe going into college or right out of college, they get really mad at them for not understanding money basics and how to save and how to invest and not getting into debt. So I think not talking really is the biggest mistake parents make.
What if they don't know enough?
If they don't know enough, they have to read my book.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. That's why I called it Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. And I feel like so far the best compliment I've gotten was from a mom blogger who said, well, the secret of your book really is you're teaching parents all the stuff they don't know, and then they could teach their kids. And I do think, and I've always said for the last 25 years I've been doing this, that understanding the basics of money, understanding compound interest and how not to get into credit card debt or how to get out of it is so simple when you kind of think about it very clearly and you just kind of spell out what are the five or six things you need to know. And I believe that explaining that to kids can be part of your everyday conversations with them. You don't have to sit down and have a big talk. But if you know, for example, studies show if you cave into your preschooler's demand at the checkout line, mm-hmm. that actually could make him more likely to misuse credit cards as an adult. Hmm. Or the fact that, you know, allowance is one of those topics that parents really sweat about, like, oh, should we, shouldn't we, should we tie it to chores? And the bottom line there is no answer. I looked at over two dozen studies. Some say giving allowance makes your kid become entitled. Some say giving your kid allowance makes them become more self-reliant. The most important thing is to be consistent and tell your kid what the money they have is to be used for and what you're going to pay for separately.
And by the way, you say don't tie chores to allowance.
That's right. I mean, there was an interesting study out of University of Minnesota that found that when you give kids chores at young ages, 3 to 5 years old, and you don't want to tie it to money because that sort of takes away the idea that this is a responsibility that's part of being a family, being a team. And when you give kids allowance very early, when they're older, they do very well when they're trying to get a job or they're more consistent in graduating from school. And there are all these studies now showing how when we do things when kids are really little, in fact, by age 3, they're saying now kids can really understand basic money concepts like exchange or something has value. My favorite thing was I was on Sesame Street with Elmo a couple of years ago and got to teach Elmo about savings. And what was interesting, they actually did a study after the show and they had a group of parents who watched it, a group of parents who didn't. And they found that the parents who watched the show with their kids, not only did their kids learn about money, but more parents started to save. So I feel like this is one of those topics that, you know, you go to the store, you talk about needs and wants. We, you know, really need milk, but we really want chocolate milk. And how do you live a daily life without having to sit down and have very long conversations, but can offer age-appropriate information to, say, 11 or 12-year-old who wants to know about investing. I think they're just basic concepts that people can understand their own situation better, but and then most importantly, explain to their kids what they hope they wish they knew when they were younger.
How early should a kid start investing, or how early should they even open up a bank account for themselves?
Right. Well, opening a bank account, you know, a lot of this was when I was a kid, when I was about 7 or 8, there was a local bank. We went and we got our checkbook savings, yeah, passbook account. It was so exciting. And you see, and now everything's done online. I think kids don't see their parents paying bills anymore with the check register at the kitchen table. So I think
or going to the bank and putting the money in that little vacuum tube and watching it go
yes
up. Remember those?
Yes, yeah, yes. And I think that now the importance of going to a physical bank with your kid by age, say 7, 8, 9, and explaining what you're doing and saying, we're putting our money here because it'll be protected. And also, we're going to put our money here because we'll get a little extra money called interest and explain what that is. And then they'll be really bummed when they hear it's only 0.5%. But you could also shop around for banks online with them. And that experience, I think, for a kid can really make a difference. And you remember those things. I mean, you really remember, gee, I got a higher interest rate, or my mom was buying a TV, so I found it cheaper online, and she let me save a certain percentage of how much I saved for her. I think those kind of lessons are really valuable and are also memorable when you're a kid.
We're speaking with Beth Koebleiner, whose new book is called Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. And Beth, what about credit cards? When should a kid get a credit card?
I would say junior year in college.
Oh, so and not until they're 20, 21, 22
exactly
years old.
Exactly. And here's why. And that sounds sort of radical. Now, a lot of us got credit cards when we were in college. There were tables and you just sign your name. One girl, just woman, told me recently, yeah, she was at a frat party. Someone handed her a card. She just signed her name and that was it. She got the credit card. I think that, first of all, the CARD Act of 2009 that was passed said you have to be 21 in order to get a credit card, if you don't have a parent cosign or if you don't have any income, which I think is a really good thing. A lot of parents have been cosigning credit cards with kids. And I think one issue there is, in some cases, the kid may or may not be building up credit. So you have to check, because that's obviously something you want to start thinking about when you're giving a kid a credit card. But also, it could mess up your credit as a parent.
Right.
I think that starting in, say, junior year, it makes sense because a child is used to being out on their own. And I think having a credit card, then they can start buying things and paying it off. But I have to say, a lot of people I know have told me they sent their kids to college and really smart kids. And one, you know, a couple of times I've heard the same story. Their kid called and said, I was hacked. My debit card account was hacked. And the parents said, what do you mean? They're like, all the money's gone. And then they go through it and you're like, well, I did actually go out to dinner with my friends. And I did take a trip to DC. Yeah. So I think, you know, there's so many new things you have to do when you're in college and you're starting college. And getting a credit card junior year or senior year is not a bad idea. I do think there's a myth running around. Parents are a little stressed out, like, oh, our kid has to have credit, you know, a good credit record by the time they're 20 or 21. There's time. You can
right
do this. And I think that we've learned that from previous generations, obviously, that getting in too much credit card debt can be really problematic throughout your life. And I think that millennials, we do see now, are doing that a lot less.
Well, I'll save people at least one page of your book by giving advice that I've learned over the years, especially in covering personal finance issues, mm-hmm, that you should always pay your credit card bill in full if you can every single month. Do not
absolutely
carry a balance. It is the dumbest thing to do from a financial perspective.
Yeah, and we've gotten away from that. You know, that was certainly the case. My parents were Depression generation, so they never, ever, in, you know, my dad's 87, and in his whole lifetime, he'd never paid a late payment. And then it became really, you know, current for people to say, yeah, I have a lot of credit card debt, and I carry it from month to month, and that's how I finance my lifestyle. And hopefully, I mean, I think we have moved back to some extent in sort of realizing how insanely expensive that is. And you're right. One late payment, you know, it's not like handing in a paper late. If you hand in a paper late, maybe they shave off a little bit of your grade. Well, if you hand in a credit card payment late, it will be on your credit record. And it could be there for 7 years, and it drops your credit score.
And you're paying 25% interest or whatever.
Not to mention that. Exactly. So I think those are all conversations. When you have them with kids, you know, even middle schoolers, they're kind of interested in the stuff. They want to know about money. And I think talking about it can really make it interesting to them, and they'll remember.
Before it's time for somebody to get their own credit card, mm-hmm. you say, don't ever give your kid your credit card number when they want to buy something. Why not?
Well, it's such a common scenario now, unfortunately. And it almost, you know, happened to me as a parent. I have a 13-year-old and calling out, hey, mom, can I order this, you know, for my birthday in advance? Like, okay, that seems like a reasonable thing. And you give them your credit card number, and before you know it, they have access to that number. And not my son, but kids will sort of start either charging things or entering the number. It's become way too casual. I think 20, 30 years ago, you'd never just hand your kid your credit card and say, here, charge what you want. So I think there's a lot of re-education we need to do as families about, you know, the very basics of, I work, I have a job, let me take you to my job. This is where I work, and this is how I make money, and that's how we buy things. And really talking about, you know, we have priorities as a family, and there are trade-offs. And one thing is, if I decide to type in my credit card number, you don't have access to that number, and we certainly don't share information online, whether it's our address or the school you go to or any bank information. It's just too easy, as we all know, for that information to get into the wrong hands.
That's Beth Kobliner. Her new book is Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. It's got tips for kids, although, quite frankly, it could probably be used by a lot of adults, too, who never learned some of these things. So, Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
If you have a Vizio TV, a smart TV, you're going to want to hear this next story. The company agreed yesterday to pay more than $2 million to settle a lawsuit that accused Vizio of tracking its customers' home viewing habits and then selling that data, all without permission. Joining us now is Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. He's in New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what was Vizio doing with these smart TVs exactly?
All right, so they're accused of compiling data from their internet-connected TVs starting in 2014, and then also retrofitting smart TVs sold back as far as 2010 using a software update. And so it comes to a total of 11 million smart TVs. That's quite a few of them out there. And the way this works was they're collecting a selection of pixels on the screen, and then they would match those to a database of TV, movie, and commercial content. This is according to the Federal Trade Commission.
So what exactly were they collecting? What did they want to know?
Well, they're identifying viewing data from cable or broadband service providers, set-top boxes, streaming devices, DVD players, and over-the-air broadcasts. I mean, all added up to, according to the FTC again, as many as 100 billion data points each day for millions of TVs, which then could potentially be paired up with other data on the customer themselves.
So just spying on people, basically, and trying to figure out what they've been watching and what they are watching. What is Vizio saying about these accusations?
Well, they're saying that they never paired the viewing data with personally identifiable information, you know, names or contact information. They said that the data was compiled in aggregate and that, you know, the company used that to create summary reports on its customers' viewing behaviors. But the FTC says that the information was sold to along with information such as customers' IP addresses. And then the companies that bought this data could then use it to track and target customers.
So what happens now with the data that was collected, or what does the company have to do now?
All right. Well, Vizio has agreed to delete user data it collected before March 1st, 2016. And going forward, it's got to obtain express consent for collecting data from you when you're watching your TV.
What should people do about this? And by the way, it may not just be Vizio. Vizio is the company that has had to pay this fine over this issue, but a lot of us have smart TVs now. And by the way, some of them might have cameras on them as well that I guess a company, if they wanted to, could try to use without your permission. But what should people do if they're concerned about being tracked by their smart TV?
I don't know. Maybe you should ask yourself, what would Edward Snowden do? I just saw that film. Mm. And he would put Band-Aids on the cameras. But, I mean, the best advice is, you know, if you've got a connected TV from any brand, check the terms of services, the privacy policy. You know, if the TV menu has privacy settings, take a look at those too.
So you can go into the privacy settings and potentially make it impossible for the company to spy on you.
Potentially so. Yeah, that's exactly what you can try to do, or at least find out what you've agreed to when you connected the TV to the internet.
Scary story, I must say. Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal. Your TV may be watching you. Jason, thank you.
You bet.
President Trump's ban on travelers from seven predominantly Muslim countries affects Iranians more than anyone. You've probably heard about Asghar Farhadi, nominated for Best Foreign Film and also Artist in Residence at the American Film Institute in Los Angeles. He's in Iran now, but says he won't attend the Oscars even if an exception is made. It's too risky. The Iranian government issued a counter ban on Americans traveling to Iran, which surprised many Americans who didn't know there was travel. Iranian-American journalists have been jailed in Iran. A 2016 poll found three-quarters of Americans don't like the country, many since the Islamic Revolution that overthrew the U.S.-installed Shah in 1979. But Iranians say there's a difference between their hardline government and their people, 35,000 of whom have non-immigrant U.S. visas. Kamen Mohammadi lives in London but visits Iran frequently. Her novel, The Cypress Tree, is a love letter to her country. She also co-authored The Lonely Planet Guide to Iran and joins us from the BBC studios in London. Kamen, what would you want Americans to know?
Well, Robin, that's a great question. I think the first thing that I would want Americans to know is, you know, we're not that different to you. The largest populations of Iranians outside of Iran are in the U.S., mm-hmm. I believe. And you know how, I mean, in Los Angeles, you know, it's called Tehranjulis. And I met a British friend whose ex-husband is an Iranian guy who's now living in California. And when her kids go to visit him in L.A. in the summer, they come back and they think that in America they speak Farsi because they just go to this, you know, extremely Iranian part. So that immigration has gone on for many, many, many decades. So these are highly educated people. They hold great jobs. They contribute a lot to society. Iranians who are in Iran are not so different. You know, Iran has been probably the most progressive country in the Middle East. For example, our women got the vote in 1963, which is way ahead of a lot of our other sisters in the Middle East. Currently, something like 65% of university graduates are women. A third of the workforce in terms of teaching, the civil service, those kinds of jobs are held by women. So, you know, there are a lot more liberties and there's a lot more progress in Iran than we would imagine.
Well, you write, in fact, that women in Iran have more rights than they do in Saudi Arabia. But you also point out that Iran is also a country where a woman could be stoned to death for adultery or flogged for going out in public with a man she's not married to.
I know. There are these terrific contradictions which are about, you know, what's been enshrined in Sharia law, which was adopted. I mean, Sharia law always existed in Iran, but of course it became, you know, the regime's system after the revolution. So it's true, there are very heavily discriminatory laws against women. These things are terrible. There's no defense of that, but just to say that things like flogging and yes, there's not supposed to be mingling between the sexes. And in theory, you can be taken if you have incorrect, as they call it, hijab, you know, Islamic dress, that kind of thing. In practice, those things are extremely rare. So what we tend to hear about outside of the country is the one case, you know, where that does happen.
But this is the image that many Americans have of Iran. You fled the country with your family when you were a child during the revolution in the late 1970s. And that's when Americans of a certain generation formed their opinion. This was a country that donned black head coverings and yelled death to America, took Americans hostage, and regressed into this, you know, dark shadow of the Ayatollah. So where is that country? Is that country still there in pockets?
Do you know what, Robin? You're not wrong. And that absolutely was the image, you know, what was coming out of the country in 79, 80. And I know that the hostage crisis impressed a very bad image on American minds, completely understandably. That country which went behind the veil and shrouded everyone in black is still there, I suppose, but it's mostly there for the television cameras. So when you notice that there are demonstrations being shown where people are on the street punching the air, saying death to America, burning American flags, the people that tend to turn up to those demonstrations are pretty much regime people, or, you know, they're school kids given the day off school. They're staged. You know, any travelers to the country will be extremely shocked, actually, because that's just not at all what you see when you go there. You know, what you encounter, particularly when you land in Tehran, is a really throbbing metropolis. And it's very, very modern. And actually, so are the people and so are a lot of the attitudes. But because there is this dichotomy between real life and the regime and the law, you have life being lived on several levels at the same time.
And we've talked to Marzan Satrapi, the wonderful graphic artist, one of her comic graphic books, Persepolis. She talks about this dichotomy, that there's this historic wealth of the arts and education, but pockets of this darkness.
Yes, absolutely. And I think in a way, you know, with what's going on with all of us at the moment, we're beginning to understand how that can happen, you know, how you can have a sort of disconnect between actually things that are different points of view, very strong ideologies in your own country. And I think that that's very much what's kind of happened in Iran. And what we tend to see outside of the country is the negatives.
Well, there have been failed attempts at a popular uprising. And while the Iranian government has backed what are seen by the West as terrorist organizations, Hezbollah, for instance, we're only aware of one modern-day case of an Iranian perpetrating a terrorist act in the U.S. This was in 2006. It was actually a naturalized U.S. citizen who'd come to the U.S. when they were two, who drove his SUV into a crowd at the University of North Carolina, injuring many. But still, that's the one that we could find.
Thank you for pointing that out. And you know what? I've never come across much sort of support at all on the ground in Iran for the organizations that the regime gives money to. You know, Iranians see themselves as quite sophisticated people. As you mentioned, we have this extraordinarily long and rich history. You know, Iran is the longest occupied piece of land by a single race in the world.
Well, there's much to know, and it occurs as well that if people are highly vetted, and they have been in order to get these visas, these are professors and grad students that are highly vetted, it would seem that in keeping Iranians from coming to the U.S., it's keeping them from coming to what seems like a democracy that many of them yearn for.
Absolutely. And, you know, Iranians love America. And I've said this often in talks that I give in the U.S., which is that, you know, Iran and America, it's like a love story that's gone a little bit wrong. There's great taste for American products. You know, American popular culture is extremely popular. And as you say, the people who are coming over have been highly vetted and they're usually extremely highly educated. And Iran, you know, has the highest rate of brain drain in the world. A lot of those massive big brains are coming to America. So by stopping that from happening, America also misses out, you know.
Well, you are the co-author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Iran. And again, we should caution that Americans traveling in Iran were jailed after they were detained near the Iraqi border, which was considered a security issue. But if you're in the heart of Iran, what should you see?
Well, it's a huge country. Obviously, you're going to have to see Tehran because while Tehran isn't always beautiful, it's extremely vital. And it's the burst of energy and modern sort of culture, Iranian culture going on there. The arts is incredible and really, really must be seen. You can't miss Isfahan. Isfahan is in my opinion, the most gloriously beautiful place in the world. It was the capital of the Safavid dynasty, and they made the most beautiful decorative arts and architecture. Shiraz has beautiful Persian gardens. There are nightingales and roses, and you go mad with the smell of the orange blossom in the spring.
Okay, you got us. It might be a while, though. Does that hurt that there may now be this ban?
Yeah. You know what? I think so, because it's been coming up to 38 years that we have been waiting for things to normalize. I think that the best way for people to learn about each other is to meet and to visit each other's countries. So I think bans on any side are really unuseful.
What would you say to Americans who genuinely fear? Are they genuinely fearful?
You know, I respect that. I've given lectures in America and I've spoken to a lot of people about their concerns. So it's not something that I'd want to dismiss. But I think you have to look at the facts. You know, people who are scared, I would say, you know, go and read my book, for example, or someone else's, about actually what the country's like, what the people are like. See if you could go to a Persian restaurant, meet some Iranian people. You know, I think the answer to fear, which we all have increasingly, is not to withdraw, but to really build those bridges, you know, to reach up outside of ourselves. And I think human to human contact is the most powerful thing.
That's Kamen Mohammadi, an Iranian-British journalist, co-author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Iran and author of the novel The Cypress Tree. We'll link you to her website at oursherenow.org. Kamen, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin. That was wonderful.
Protests of President Donald Trump started even before he took office, and they've been widespread since his inauguration. Members of a self-described resistance to the president are organizing themselves online, many of them using a document that emerged in December called Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda. One of its founders says the goal is to build a Tea Party for the left. We're joined now by Ezra Levin, co-author of that document and co-founder of the nonprofit Indivisible. Ezra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the guide for resisting the Trump agenda? Just the couple of bullet points that people should know.
Yeah. So the guide is about how individual constituents can resist the Trump agenda. And it's based on a basic understanding of how American democracy works, which is that Donald Trump's agenda doesn't depend on Donald Trump. It depends on individual members of Congress choosing to rubber stamp it instead of fight it. And the great thing about Congress, and there aren't very many great things, it's got an approval rating on par with toenail fungus for a reason,
right.
But every member of Congress wakes up every morning thinking, how am I going to get reelected? That gives constituents a lot of power. So we laid out a system inspired a lot by the Tea Party and the smart strategies and tactics they implemented for progressives today. Who want to resist the Trump agenda.
Which is basically call your representative, email your representative, go to the town meetings, do the things that the Tea Party members did back in 2009.
That's more or less right. What I would say is the more difficult and time-consuming the action is, the more impactful it's going to be. Emails are really easy to ignore. Calls are pretty good. The very best thing you can do is show up in person at town halls or at public events and make clear that you expect that member of Congress to be your voice in Washington and not a rubber stamp for Donald Trump.
So why do you think that up until now, the left in this country hasn't been engaging in this kind of thing, at least not in as significant a way as the right?
Well, I think there are many instances throughout American history of progressives voicing their concerns and lobbying their members of Congress. I think what we've seen over the last 8 years is a progressive president. And so naturally, you've seen a grassroots movement not based in opposition to him in the progressive wing of the country, but in the conservative wing. I think what we're seeing now is a unique threat to American democracy in the form of President Trump, and progressives are coming up and making their voices heard and leading this movement at the local level themselves directly as a result.
And voting, I assume, is the most important thing.
Yeah, but the next elections for Congress, or most of them, aren't until 2018. We don't want to send the message that that's your only role in the democratic process as a constituent. You have a role to make your voice heard right now. There are meetings going on every single weekend by groups who are trying to figure out how to talk to their members of Congress. So we don't have to wait to 2018 to resist the Trump agenda. We can start doing it right now, and folks already have. Now, the Tea Party didn't win everything. Obamacare was passed.
Right.
Dodd-Frank was passed. But the Tea Party did win many battles, and they slowed down the mechanics of Congress so that President Obama was unfortunately able to get done much less. We think progressives are stronger today. We think progressives are more energized, and we think they're better organized. So, in fact, using the exact same strategies and tactics, they can have a big impact, and they really already have been having a big impact.
I want to ask you about an accusation that the president and many others on the right have made about the protests that we've been seeing around the country. Here's Fox News's Brian Kilmeade asking White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer about it this week on Fox and Friends.
Do you sense that instead of being an organic disruption, do you sense that there's an organized pushback and people are being paid to protest?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, protesting has become a profession now. They have every right to do that, don't get me wrong, but I think that we need to call it what it is. It's not these organic uprisings that we've seen through the last several decades. You know, the Tea Party was a very organic movement. This has become a very paid AstroTurf-type movement.
Ezra, how do you respond to that? And do you have to prove, you know, that there aren't paid protesters in order to push back on this accusation?
Yeah, I think it's funny to hear that. It's just so off base. And I will say that there are many in the progressive community who continue to think of the Tea Party as a purely AstroTurf campaign that was fully financed by the Koch brothers. That's actually not really true, that there was support from the above for the Tea Party, but it was fundamentally an organic movement of a lot of disgruntled conservatives who didn't like the president and wanted to resist. What we're seeing today in the progressive community is very, very much the same thing. I will say the Indivisible Project is entirely volunteer-run right now. There are over 100 volunteers who are coming together. The typical group is a handful of people who come together for the first time who haven't been politically engaged but want to resist Trump's agenda in some way. And we see them bring 20 people together in their living room, and then in the next meeting, it's 200 people in their community at a church. I would challenge anybody on the other side to find somebody pulling the strings of this movement. It doesn't exist.
That's Ezra Levin, who co-wrote Indivisible Guide and is president of the board of the nonprofit Indivisible. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Ezra, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.